Frodo was on his way to visit Cecilia and Alexander to give them the news that Harriet had risen from the dead. He hurried away, leaving Blomquist to his solitary musings. Sallander stopped and filled her tank at a petrol station north of Uppsala. She had been riding doggedly, staring straight ahead. She paid quickly and got back on her bike. She started it up and rode to the exit, where she stopped, undecided. She was still in a terrible mood. She was furious when she left Hedeby, but her rage had slowly dissolved during the ride. She could not make up her mind why she was so angry with Blomquist, or even if he was the one she was angry with. She thought of Martin Wanger, and Harriet fucking Wanger, and Dirk fucking Froder, and the whole damned Wanger clan sitting in Hedestad, reigning over their little empire and plotting against each other. They had needed her help. Normally they wouldn't even have said hello to her in the street, let alone entrust her with their repellent secrets. Fucking riff-raff. She took a deep breath and thought about her mother, whom she had consigned to ashes that very morning. She would never be able to mend things. Her mother's death meant that the wound would never heal, since she would never now get an answer to the questions she had wanted to ask. She thought about Armansky standing behind her at the crematorium. She should have said something to him, at least given him some sign that she knew he was there. But if she did that, he would have taken it as a pretext for trying to structure her life. If she gave him her little finger, he'd take her whole arm, and he would never understand. She thought about the lawyer, Bjurman, who was still her guardian, and who, at least for the time being, had been neutralized and was doing as he was told. She felt an implacable hatred, and clenched her teeth. And she thought about Mikhail Blomquist, and wondered what he would say when he found out that she was a ward of the court, and that her entire life was a fucking rat's nest. It came to her that she really was not angry with him. He was just the person on whom she had vented her anger, when what she had wanted most of all was to murder somebody. Several people. Being angry with him was pointless. She felt strangely ambivalent towards him. He stuck his nose in other people's business and poked around in her life, and... But she had also enjoyed working with him. Even that was an odd feeling, to work with somebody. She wasn't used to that, but it had been unexpectedly painless. He did not mess with her. He did not try to tell her how to live her life. She was the one who had seduced him, not vice versa. And besides, it had been satisfying. So why did she feel as if she wanted to kick him in the face? She sighed and unhappily raised her eyes to see an intercontinental roar past on the E4. Blomquist was still in the garden at 8 when he was roused by the rattle of the motorcycle crossing the bridge, and saw Sallander riding towards the cottage. She put her bike on its stand and took off her helmet. She came up to the garden table and felt the coffee pot, which was empty and cold. Blomquist stood up, gazing at her in surprise. She took the coffee pot and went into the kitchen. When she came back out, she had taken off her leathers and sat down in jeans and a T-shirt, with a slogan, "I can be a regular bitch. Just try me." "I thought you'd be in Stockholm by now," he said.
"I turned round in Uppsala."
"Quite a ride."
"I'm sore."
"Why did you turn around?" No answer. He waited her out while they drank coffee. After 10 minutes, she said, reluctantly,
"I like your company."
Those were words that had never before passed her lips.
"It was interesting to work with you on this case."
"I enjoyed working with you, too," he said.
"Hmm.
The fact is, I've never worked with such a brilliant researcher. Okay, I know you're a hacker, and hang out in suspect circles in which you can set up an illegal wiretap in London in 24 hours, but you get results." She looked at him for the first time since she had sat at the table. He knew so many of her secrets.
"That's just how it is. I know computers. I've never had a problem with reading a text and absorbing what it said."
"Your photographic memory," he said softly.
"I admit it. I just have no idea how it works. It's not only computers and telephone networks, but the motion in my bike and TV sets and vacuum cleaners and chemical processes and formulae in astrophysics. I'm a nutcase. I admit it. A freak.
Blomqvist frowned. He sat quietly for a long time. Asperger's syndrome, he thought, or something like that. A talent for seeing patterns and understanding abstract reasoning where other people perceive only white noise. Salander was staring down at the table. Most people would give an eye tooth to have such a gift.
I don't want to talk about it.
We'll drop it.
Are you glad you came back? I don't know. Maybe it was a mistake.
Lisbeth, can you define the word friendship for me?
It's when you like somebody.
Sure. But what is it that makes you like somebody? She shrugged. Friendship, my definition, is built on two things, he said. Respect and trust. Both elements have to be there. And it has to be mutual. You can have respect for someone, but if you don't have trust, the friendship will crumble. She was still silent.
I understand that you don't want to discuss yourself with me, but some day you're going to have to decide whether you trust me or not. I want us to be friends, but I can't do it all by myself.
I like having sex with you.
Sex has nothing to do with friendship. Sure, friends can have sex, but if I had to choose between sex and friendship when it comes to you, there's no doubt which I would pick.
I don't get it. Do you want to have sex with me or not?
You shouldn't have sex with people you're working with, he muttered. It just leads to trouble.
Did I miss something here? Or isn't it true that you and Erica Berger fuck every time you get the chance? And she's married?
Erica and I have a history that started long before we started working together. The fact that she's married is none of your business.
Oh, I see. All of a sudden you're the one who doesn't want to talk about yourself, and there I was learning that friendship is a matter of trust.
What I mean is that I don't discuss a friend behind her back. I'd be breaking her trust. I wouldn't discuss you with Erica behind your back either.
Salander thought about that. This had become an awkward conversation. She did not like awkward conversations.
I do like having sex with you, she said.
I like it too. But I'm still old enough to be your father.
I don't give a shit about your age.
No, you can't ignore our age difference. It's no sort of basis for a lasting relationship.
Who said anything about lasting? Salander said. We just finished up a case in which men with fucked-up sexuality played a prominent role. If I had to decide, men like that would be exterminated, every last one of them.
Well, at least you don't compromise.
No,
she said, giving him her crooked non-smile.
But at least you're not like them.
She got up.
Now I'm going to take a shower, and then I think I'll get into your bed naked. If you think you're too old, you'll have to go and sleep on the camp bed.
Whatever hang-ups Salander had, modesty certainly was not one of them. He managed to lose every argument with her. After a while, he washed up the coffee things and went into the bedroom. They got up at 10, took a shower together, and ate breakfast out in the garden. At 11, Dirk Frode called and said that the funeral would take place at 2 in the afternoon, and he asked if they were planning to attend.
I shouldn't think so, said Mikael.
Frode asked if he could come over around 6 for a talk. Mikael said that would be fine. He spent a few hours sorting the papers into the packing crates and carrying them over to Henrik's office. Finally, he was left with only his own notebooks and the 2 binders about the Hans-Erik Wennerström affair that he hadn't opened in 6 months. He sighed and stuffed them into his bag. Frode rang to say he was running late and did not reach the cottage until 8. He was still in his funeral suit and looked harried when he sat down on the kitchen bench and gratefully accepted the cup of coffee that Salander offered him. She sat at the side table with her computer while Blomqvist asked how Harriet's reappearance had been received by the family as a whole.
You might say that it has overshadowed Martin's demise. Now the media have found out about her too.
And how are you explaining the situation?
Harriet talked with a reporter from the Courier. Her story is that she ran away from home because she didn't get along with her family, but that she obviously has done well in the world since she's the head of a very substantial enterprise.
Blomqvist whistled.
I discovered that there was money in Australian sheep, but I didn't know the station was doing that well.
Her sheep station is going superbly. But that isn't her only source of income. The Cochrane Corporation is in mining, opals, manufacturing, transport, electronics, and a lot of other things, too.
Wow.
So what's going to happen now? Honestly, I don't know. People have been turning up all day, and the family has been together for the first time in years. They're here from both Frederick and Johann Wanger's sides, and quite a few from the younger generation, too. The ones in their 20s and up. There are probably around 40 Wangers in Hedderstad this evening. Half of them are at the hospital wearing out Henrik. The other half are at the Grand Hotel talking to Harriet.
Harriet must be the big sensation. How many of them know about Martin?
So far it's just me, Henrik, and Harriet. We had a long talk together. Martin and... Your uncovering of his unspeakable life, it's overshadowing just about everything for us at the moment. It has brought an enormous crisis for the company to a head.
I can understand that.
There is no natural heir. But Harriet is staying in Hedderstad for a while. The family will work out who owns what, how the inheritance is to be divided, and so on. She actually has a share of it that would have been quite large if she had been here the whole time. It's a nightmare.
Mikael laughed.
Froda was not laughing at all. Isabella had a collapse at the funeral. She's in the hospital now. Henrik says he won't visit her.
Good for Henrik.
However, Anita is coming over from London. I am to call a family meeting for next week. It will be the first time in 25 years that she's participated.
Who will be the new CEO?
Birger is after the job, but he's out of the question. What's going to happen is that Henrik will step in as CEO pro tem from his sickbed, until we hire either someone from outside or someone from within the family.
Blomqvist raised his eyebrows.
Harriet? You can't be serious.
Why not? We're talking about an exceptionally competent and respected businesswoman.
She has a company in Australia to look after.
True, but her son Jeff Cochrane is minding the store in her absence.
He's the studs manager on a sheep ranch. If I understood the matter correctly, he sees to it that the correct sheep mate with each other.
He also has a degree in economics from Oxford and a law degree from Melbourne.
Blomqvist thought about the sweaty, muscular man with his shirt off who had driven him into and through the ravine. He tried to imagine him in a pinstripe suit.
Why not?
All of this will take time to work out, Froda said, but she would be a perfect CEO. With the right support team, she could represent a whole new deal for the company.
She doesn't have the experience.
That's true. She can't just pop up out of more or less nowhere and start micromanaging the company. But the Wanger Corporation is international, and we could certainly have an American CEO who doesn't speak a word of Swedish. It's only business, when all's said and done.
Sooner or later you're going to have to face up to the problem of Martin's basement.
I know. But we can't say anything without destroying Harriet. I'm glad I'm not the one who has to make the decision about this.
Damn it, Dirk. You won't be able to bury the fact that Martin was a serial killer.
Mikael, I'm in a very uncomfortable position.
Tell me.
I have a message from Henrik. He thanks you for the outstanding work you did, and says that he considers the contract fulfilled. That means he is releasing you from any further obligations, and that you no longer have to live or work here in Hedderstad, etc. So, taking effect immediately, you can move back to Stockholm and devote yourself to your other pursuits.
He wants me to vanish from the scene. Is that the gist of it?
Absolutely not. He wants you to visit him for a conversation about the future. He says he hopes that his involvement on the board of Millennium can proceed without restrictions, but...
Froda looked even more uncomfortable, if that was possible.
Don't tell me, Dirk. He no longer wants me to write a history of the Wanger family.
Dirk Froda nodded. He picked up a notebook, opened it, and pushed it over to Mikael.
He wrote you this letter.
Dear Mikael, I have nothing but respect for your integrity, and I don't intend to insult you by trying to tell you what to write. You may write and publish whatever you like, and I won't exert any pressure on you whatsoever. Our contract remains valid if you want to continue. You have enough material to finish the Chronicle of the Wanger family. Mikhail. I've never begged anyone for anything in my entire life. I've always thought that a person should follow his morals and his convictions. This time I have no choice. I am, with this letter, begging you, both as a friend and as part owner of Millennium, to refrain from publishing the truth about Gottfried and Martin. I know that's wrong, but I see no way out of this darkness. I have to choose between two evils, and in this case there are no winners. I beg you not to write anything that would further hurt Harriet. You know firsthand what it's like to be the subject of a media campaign. The campaign against you was of quite modest proportions. You can surely imagine what it would be like for Harriet if the truth were to come out. She has been tormented for 40 years, and shouldn't have to suffer any more for the deeds that her brother and her father committed. And I beg you to think through the consequences this story might have for the thousands of employees in the company. This could crush her and annihilate us. Henrik.
Henrik also says that if you require compensation for financial losses that may arise from your refraining from publishing the story, he is entirely open to discussion. You can set any financial demands you think fit.
Henrik Wanger is trying to shut me up.
Tell him that I wish he had never given me this offer.
The situation is just as troublesome for Henrik as it is for you. He likes you very much and considers you his friend.
Henrik Wanger is a clever bastard, Blomqvist said.
He was suddenly furious.
He wants to hush up the story. He's playing on my emotions, and he knows I like him, too. And what he's also saying is that I have a free hand to publish, and if I do so, he would have to revise his attitude towards Millennium.
Everything changed when Harriet stepped onto the stage.
And now Henrik is feeling out what my price tag might be. I don't intend to hang Harriet out to dry, but somebody has to say something about the women who died in Martin's basement.
Dear, we don't even know how many women he tortured and slaughtered. Who's going to speak up on their behalf?
Salander looked up from her computer. Her voice was almost inaudible as she said to Froda,
"Isn't there anyone in your company who's going to try to shut me up?"
Froda looked astonished. Once again he had managed to ignore her existence.
"If Martin Wanger were alive at this moment, I would have hung him out to dry," she went on. "Whatever agreement Mikhail made with you, I would have sent every detail about him to the nearest evening paper. And if I could, I would have stuck him down in his own torture hole and tied him to that table and stuck needles through his balls. Unfortunately, he's dead."
She turned to Blomqvist.
"I'm satisfied with the solution. Nothing we do can repair the harm that Martin Wanger did to his victims. But an interesting situation has come up. You're in a position where you can continue to harm innocent women, especially that Harriet whom you so warmly defended in the car on the way up here. So my question to you is, which is worse? The fact that Martin Wanger raped her out in the cabin, or that you're going to do it in print? You have a fine dilemma. Maybe the Ethics Committee of the Journalists Association can give you some guidance."
She paused. Blomqvist could not meet her gaze. He stared down at the table.
"But I'm not a journalist," she said at last.
"What do you want?" Dear Froda asked.
"Martin videotaped his victims. I want you to do your damnedest to identify as many as you can and see to it that their families receive suitable compensation. And then I want the Wanger Corporation to donate 2 million kroner annually and in perpetuity to the National Organization for Women's Crisis Centers and Girls' Crisis Centers in Sweden."
Froda weighed the price tag for a minute. Then he nodded.
"Can you live with that, Mika?" Salander said.
Blomqvist felt only despair. His professional life he had devoted to uncovering things which other people had tried to hide, and he could not be party to the covering up of the appalling crimes committed in Martin Wanger's basement. He who had lambasted his colleagues for not publishing the truth, here he sat, discussing, negotiating even, the most macabre cover-up he had ever heard of. He sat in silence for a long time, then he nodded his assent.
"So be it," Froda said. "And with regard to Henrik's offer for financial compensation,
He can shove it up his backside. And Dich, I want you to leave now. I understand your position, but right now I'm so furious with you and Henrik and Harriet that if you stay any longer, we might not be friends any more.
Frodo made no move to go.
I can't leave yet. I'm not done. I have another message to deliver, and you're not going to like this one either. Henrik is insisting that I tell you tonight. You can go up to the hospital and flay him tomorrow morning, if you wish.
Blomqvist looked up and stared at him.
Frodo went on. This has got to be the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. But I think that only complete candor with all the cards on the table can save the situation now.
So it's candor at last, is it?
When Henrik convinced you to take the job last Christmas,
Dirk said, ignoring his sarcasm,
neither he nor I thought that anything would come of it. That was exactly what he said. But he wanted to give it one last try. He had analyzed your situation, particularly with the help of the report the Fröken Sallander put together. He played on your isolation, he offered good pay, and he used the right bait.
Wennerström, Frodo nodded.
You were bluffing?
No, no, Frodo said.
Sallander raised an eyebrow with interest.
Henrik is going to make good on everything he promised. He's arranging an interview, and is going public with a direct assault on Wennerström. You can have all the details later, but roughly the situation is this. When Wennerström was employed in the finance department of the Wanger Corporation, he spent several million kronos speculating on foreign currency. This was long before foreign exchange futures became the rage. He did this without authority. One deal after another went bad, and he was sitting there with a loss of 7 million kronor that he tried to cover up, partly by cooking the books, and partly by speculating even harder. It inevitably came to light, and he was sacked.
Did he make any profit himself?
Oh, yes. He made off with about 500,000 kronor, which ironically enough became the seed money for the Wennerström Group. We have documentation for all of this. You can use the information however you like, and Henrik will back up the accusations publicly. But,
and it's a big but, Dirk, the information is worthless,
Blomqvist said, slamming his fist on the table.
It all happened 30+ years ago, and it's a closed book.
You'll get confirmation that Wennerström is a crook.
That will annoy Wennerström when it comes out, but it won't damage him any more than a direct hit from a pea shooter. He's going to shuffle the deck by putting out a press release saying that Henrik Wanger is an old has-been who's still trying to steal some business from him, and then he'll probably claim that he was acting on orders from Henrik. Even if he can't prove his innocence, he can lay down enough smoke screens that no one will take the story seriously.
Frodo looked unhappy.
You conned me, Blomqvist said.
That wasn't our intention.
I blame myself. I was grasping at straws, and I should have realized it was something like that.
He laughed abruptly.
Henrik is an old shark. He was selling a product and told me what I wanted to hear.
It's time you went, Dirk. Mikael, I'm sorry that...
Dirk, go!
Sallander did not know whether to go over to Blomqvist or to leave him in peace. He solved the problem for her by picking up his jacket without a word and slamming the door behind him. For more than an hour she waited restlessly in the kitchen. She felt so bad that she cleared the table and washed the dishes, a role she usually left to Blomqvist. She went regularly to the window to see if there was any sign of him. Finally, she was so nervous that she put on her jacket and went out to look for him. First, she walked to the marina, where lights were still on in the cabins, but there was no sign of him. She followed the path along the water, where they usually took their evening walks. Martin Wanger's house was dark and already looked abandoned. She went out to the rocks at the point where they had often sat talking, and then she went back home. He still had not returned. She went to the church, still no sign. She was at a loss to know what to do. Then she went back to her motorcycle and got a flashlight from the saddlebag and set off along the water again. It took her a while to wind her way along the half-overgrown road, and even longer to find the path to Gottfried's cabin. It loomed out of the darkness, behind some trees when she had almost reached it. He was not on the porch, and the door was locked. She had turned towards the village when she stopped and went back, all the way out to the point.
She caught sight of Blomqvist's silhouette in the darkness on the end of the jetty where Harriet Wanger had drowned her father. She sighed with relief. He heard her as she came out onto the jetty, and he turned around. She sat down next to him without a word. At last he broke the silence.
"Forgive me. I had to be alone for a while."
"I know."
She lit two cigarettes and gave him one. Blomqvist looked at her. Salander was the most asocial human being he had ever met. Usually she ignored any attempt on his part to talk about anything personal, and she had never accepted a single expression of sympathy. She had saved his life, and now she had tracked him out here in the night. He put an arm around her.
"Now I know what my price is," he said. "We've forsaken those girls. They're going to bury the whole story. Everything in Martin's basement will be vacuumed into oblivion."
Salander did not answer.
"Erica was right," he said. "I would have done more good if I'd gone to Spain for a month and then come home refreshed and taken on Venestrom. I've wasted all these months."
"If you'd gone to Spain, Martin Wanger would still be operating in his basement."
They sat together for a long time before he suggested that they go home. Blomqvist fell asleep before Salander. She lay awake listening to him breathe. After a while she went to the kitchen and sat in the dark on the kitchen bench, smoking several cigarettes as she brooded. She had taken it for granted that Wanger and Froda might con him. It was in their nature. But it was Blomqvist's problem, not hers. Or was it? At last she made a decision. She stubbed out her cigarette and went into the bedroom, turned on the lamp and shook Mikhail awake. It was 2:30 in the morning.
"What?" "I've got a question. Sit up."
Blomqvist sat up, drunk with sleep.
"When you were indicted, why didn't you defend yourself?"
Blomqvist rubbed his eyes. He looked at the clock.
"It's a long story, Elizabeth."
"I've got time. Tell me."
He sat for a long while, pondering what he should say. Finally, he decided on the truth.
"I had no defense. The information in the article was wrong."
"When I hacked your computer and read your email exchange with Berger, there were plenty of references to the Venestrom affair, but you two kept discussing practical details about the trial and nothing about what actually happened. What was it that went wrong?"
"Lisbeth, I can't let the real story get out. I fell into a trap. Erica and I are quite clear that it would damage our credibility even further if we told anyone what really happened."
"Listen, Callie Blomqvist, yesterday afternoon you sat here preaching about friendship and trust and stuff. I'm not going to put the story on the net."
Blomqvist protested.
It was the middle of the night. He could not face thinking about the whole thing now.
She went on stubbornly sitting there until he gave in. He went to the bathroom and washed his face and put the coffee pot on. Then he came back to the bed and told her about how his old school friend Robert Lindberg, in a yellow Mylar 30 in the guest marina in Arholma, had aroused his curiosity.
"You mean that your buddy was lying?"
"No, not at all. He told me exactly what he knew, and I could verify each and every word in documents from the audit at SIB. I even went to Poland and photographed the sheet metal shack where this huge big Minos company was housed. I interviewed several of the people who'd been employed at the company. They all said exactly the same thing."
"I don't get it."
Blomqvist sighed. It was a while before he spoke again.
"I had a damn good story. I still hadn't confronted Venestrom himself, but the story was airtight. If I had published it at that moment, I really would have shook him up. It might not have led to an indictment for fraud, the deal had already been approved by the auditors, but I would have damaged his reputation."
"What went wrong?"
"Somewhere along the way, somebody heard about what I was poking my nose into, and Venestrom was made aware of my existence. And all of a sudden, a whole bunch of strange things started happening. First, I was threatened. Anonymous calls from card telephones that were impossible to trace. Erica was also threatened. It was the usual nonsense. Lie down or else we're going to nail you to a barn door, and so on. She, of course, was mad as a hellcat."
He took a cigarette from Salander. "Then something extremely unpleasant happened. Late one night when I left the office, I was attacked by two men who just walked up to me and gave me a couple of punches. I got a fat lip and fell down in the street. I couldn't identify them, but one of them looked like an old biker."
"So, next?"
"All these goings-on, of course, only had the effect of making Erica very cross indeed, and I got stubborn. We beefed up security at Millennium. The problem was that the harassment was out of all proportion to the content of the story. We couldn't fathom why all this was happening.
But the story you published was something quite different.
Exactly. Suddenly we made a breakthrough. We found a source, a deep throat in Venestrom's circle. This source was literally scared to death, and we were only allowed to meet him in hotel rooms. He told us that the money from the Minos affair had been used for weapons deals in the war in Yugoslavia. Venestrom had been making deals with the right-wing Ustashi in Croatia. Not only that, the source was able to give us copies of documents to back it up.
You believed him?
He was clever. He only ever gave us enough information to lead us to the next source who would confirm the story. We were even given a photograph of one of Venestrom's closest colleagues shaking hands with the buyer. It was detailed, blockbuster material, and everything seemed verifiable. So we published. And it was a fake. It was all a fake, from beginning to end. The documents were skillful forgeries. Venestrom's lawyer was able to prove that the photograph of Venestrom's subordinate and the Ustashi leader was a montage of two different images.
Fascinating, Salander said.
In hindsight, it was very easy to see how we had been manipulated. Our original story really had damaged Venestrom. Now that story was drowned in a clever forgery. We published a story that Venestrom could pick apart point by point and prove his innocence.
You couldn't back down and tell the truth. You had absolutely no proof that Venestrom had committed the falsification.
If we had tried to tell the truth and accused Venestrom of being behind the whole thing, nobody would have believed us. It would have looked like a desperate attempt to shift the blame from our stupidity onto an innocent leader of industry.
I see.
Venestrom had two layers of protection. If the fake had been revealed, he would have been able to claim that it was one of his enemies trying to slander him. And we at Millennium would once again have lost all credibility, since we fell for something that turned out to be false.
So you chose not to defend yourself and take the prison sentence?
I deserved it, Blomqvist said. I had committed libel. Now you know. Can I go back to sleep now? He turned off the lamp and shut his eyes. Salander lay down next to him.
Venestrom is a gangster.
I know.
No, I mean, I know that he's a gangster. He works with everybody from the Russian mafia to the Colombian drug cartels.
What do you mean?
When I turned in my report to Froda, he gave me an extra assignment. He asked me to try to find out what really happened at the trial. I just started working on it when he called Armansky and cancelled the job.
I wonder why.
I assume that they scrapped the investigation as soon as you accepted Henrik Wanger's assignment. It would no longer have been of immediate interest.
And?
Well, I don't like leaving things unresolved. I had a few weeks free last spring when Armansky didn't have any jobs for me, so I did some digging into Venestrom for fun.
Blomqvist sat up and turned on the lamp and looked at Salander. He met her eyes. She actually looked guilty. Did you find out anything?
I have his entire hard disk on my computer. You can have as much proof as you need that he's a gangster.
Chapter 28. Tuesday, July 29th to Friday, October 24th. Blomqvist had been poring over Salander's computer printouts for 3 days. Boxes full of papers. The problem was that the subjects kept changing all the time. An option deal in London. A currency deal in Paris, through an agent, a company with a post office box in Gibraltar, a sudden doubling of funds in an account at the Chase Manhattan Bank in New York. And then, all those puzzling question marks, a trading company with 200,000 kroner in an untouched account registered 5 years earlier in Santiago, Chile, one of nearly 30 such companies in 12 different countries, and not a hint of what type of activity was involved. A dormant company? Waiting for what? A front for some other kind of activity? The computer gave no clue as to what was going on in Venestrom's mind, or what may have been perfectly obvious to him and so was never formulated in an electronic document. Salander was persuaded that most of these questions would never be answered. They could see the message, but without a key they would never be able to interpret the meaning. Venestrom's empire was like an onion from which one layer after another could be removed. A labyrinth of enterprises owned by one another. Companies, accounts, funds, securities. They reckoned that nobody, perhaps not even Venestrom himself, could have a complete overview. Venestrom's empire had a life of its own.
But there was a pattern, or at least a hint of a pattern, a labyrinth of enterprises owned by each other. Venestrom's empire was variously valued at between 100 and 400 billion kronor, depending on whom you asked and how it was calculated. But if companies own each other's assets, what then would be their value? They had left Hedeby Island in great haste early in the morning after Salander dropped the bomb that was now occupying every waking moment of Blomqvist's life. They drove to Salander's place and spent 2 days in front of her computer while she guided him through Venestrom's universe. He had plenty of questions. One of them was pure curiosity. "Lisbeth, how are you able to operate his computer, from a purely practical point of view?"
"It's a little invention that my friend Plaid came up with. Venestrom has an IBM laptop that he works on both at home and at the office. That means that all the information is on a single hard drive. He has a broadband connection to his property at home. Plaid invented a type of cuff that you fasten around the broadband cable, and I'm testing it out for him. Everything that Venestrom sees is registered by the cuff, which forwards the data to a server somewhere else."
"Doesn't he have a firewall?" Salander smiled.
"Of course he has a firewall. But the point is that the cuff also functions as a type of firewall. It takes a while to hack the computer this way. Let's say that Venestrom gets an email. It goes first to Plague's cuff, and we can read it before it even passes through his firewall. But the ingenious part is that the email is rewritten, and a few bytes of source code are added. This is repeated every time he downloads anything to his computer. Pictures are even better. He does a lot of surfing on the net. Each time he picks up a porn picture or opens a new home page, we add several rows of source code. After a while, in several hours or several days, depending on how much he uses the computer, Venestrom has downloaded an entire program of approximately 3 megabytes in which each bit is linked to the next bit.
And?
When the last bits are in place, the program is integrated with his internet browser. To him, it will look as though his computer is locked up, and he has to restart it. During the restart, a whole new software program is installed. He uses Internet Explorer. The next time he starts Explorer, he's really starting a whole different program that's invisible on his desktop and looks and functions just like Explorer, but it also does a lot of other things. First, it takes control of his firewall and makes sure that everything is working. Then it starts to scan the computer and transmits bits of information every time he clicks the mouse while he's surfing. After a while, again depending on how much he surfs, we've accumulated a complete mirror image of the contents of his hard drive on a server somewhere, and then it's time for the HT.
HT?
Sorry, Plague calls it the HT. Hostile Takeover.
I see.
The really subtle thing is what happens next. When the structure is ready, Venestrom has 2 complete hard drives, one on his own machine and one on our server. The next time he boots up his computer, it's actually the mirrored computer that's starting. He's no longer working on his own computer. In reality, he's working on our server. His computer will run a little slower, but it's virtually not noticeable. And when I'm connected to the server, I can tap his computer in real time. Each time Venestrom presses a key on his computer, I see it on mine.
Your friend is also a hacker?
He's the one who arranged the telephone tap in London. He's a little out of it socially, but on the net, he's a legend.
Okay, Blomqvist said, giving her a resigned smile. Question number 2. Why didn't you tell me about Venestrom earlier?
You never asked me.
And if I never did ask you? Let's suppose that I never met you. You would have sat here, knowing that Venestrom was a gangster, while Millennium went bankrupt?
Nobody asked me to expose Venestrom for what he is, Salander replied in a know-it-all voice.
Yes, but what if?
I did tell you, she said.
Blomqvist dropped the subject. Salander burned the contents of Venestrom's hard drive, about 5 gigabytes, onto 10 CDs, and she felt as if she had more or less moved into Blomqvist's apartment. She waited patiently, answering all the questions he asked.
I can't understand how he can be so fucking dim to put all his dirty laundry on one hard drive, he said. If it ever got into the hands of the police.
People aren't very rational. He has to believe that the police would never think of confiscating his computer.
Above suspicion. I agree that he's an arrogant bastard, but he must have security consultants telling him how to handle his computer. There's material on this machine going all the way back to 1993.
The computer itself is relatively new. It was manufactured a year ago, but he seems to have transferred all his old correspondence and everything else onto the hard drive instead of storing it on CDs. But at least he's using an encryption program.
Which is totally useless,
if you're inside his computer and reading the passwords every time he types them in. After they'd been back in Stockholm for 4 days, Mom called on Blomqvist's mobile at 3 in the morning. Henry Cortez was at a bar with his girlfriend tonight.
Uh-huh,
Blomqvist said sleepily. On the way home, they ended up at Centralen's bar.
Not a very good place for a seduction.
Listen, Dahlman is on holiday. Henry discovered him, sitting at a table with some guy.
And?
Henry recognized the man from his byline pick. Christa Söder.
I don't think I recognize the name, but...
He works for the Monopoly Financial magazine, which is owned by the Wennerström Group.
Blomqvist sat up straight in bed.
Are you there?
I'm here. That might not mean anything. Söder is a journalist and he might be an old friend.
Maybe I'm being paranoid, but a while ago Millennium bought a story from a freelancer. The week before we were going to publish it, Söder ran an exposé that was almost identical. It was the story about the mobile telephone manufacturer and the defective component.
I hear what you're saying. But that sort of thing does happen.
Have you talked to Erica?
No, she's not back until next week.
Don't do anything. I'll call you back later, Blomqvist said.
Problems?
Salander asked.
Millennium, Blomqvist said. I have to go there.
Want to come along? The editorial offices were deserted. It took Salander 3 minutes to crack the password protection on Dahlman's computer, and another 2 minutes to transfer its contents to Blomqvist's iBook. Most of Dahlman's emails were probably on his own laptop, and they did not have access to it. But through his desktop computer at Millennium, Salander was able to discover that Dahlman had a Hotmail account in addition to his millennium.se address. It took her 6 minutes to crack the code and download his correspondence from the past year. 5 minutes later, Blomqvist had evidence that Dahlman had leaked information about the situation at Millennium and kept the editor of Monopoly Financial magazine updated on which stories Berger was planning for which issues. The spying had been going on at least since the previous autumn. They turned off the computers and went back to Mikhail's apartment to sleep for a few hours. He called Christa Malm at 10 a.m.
I have proof that Dahlman is working for Wennerström.
I knew it! Great! I'm going to fire that fucking pig today.
No, don't. Don't do anything at all.
Nothing?
Christa, trust me. Is Dahlman still on holiday?
Yes. He's back on Monday.
How many are in the office today?
Well, about half.
Can you call a meeting for 2?
Don't say what it's about.
I'm coming over.
There were 6 people around the conference table. Malm looked tired. Cortez looked like someone newly in love, the way that only 24-year-olds can look. Nielsen looked on edge. Malm had not told anyone what the meeting was about, but she had been with the company long enough to know that something out of the ordinary was going on, and she was annoyed that she had been kept out of the loop. The only one who looked the same as usual was the part-timer, Ingela Oskarsson, who worked 2 days a week dealing with simple administrative tasks, the subscriber list and the like. She had not looked truly relaxed since she became a mother 2 years ago. The other part-timer was the freelance reporter Lotta Karim, who had a contract similar to Cortez's and had just started back to work after her holiday. Malm had also managed to get Magnusson to come in, although he was still on holiday. Blomqvist began by greeting everyone warmly and apologizing for being so long absent.
What we're going to discuss today is something that Christa and I haven't taken up with Erica, but I can assure you that in this case I speak for her too. Today we're going to determine Millennium's future.
He paused to let the words sink in. No one asked any questions. The past year has been rough. I'm surprised and proud that none of you has reconsidered and found a job somewhere else. I have to assume that either you're stark raving mad, or wonderfully loyal and actually enjoy working on this magazine. That's why I'm going to lay the cards on the table and ask you for one last effort.
One last effort? Nielsen said. That sounds as if you're thinking of shutting down the magazine.
Exactly, Monica, Blomqvist said, and thank you for that. When she gets back, Erica is going to gather us all together for a gloomy editorial meeting and to tell us that Millennium will fold at Christmas and that you're all fired.
Now alarm began spreading through the group. Even Malm thought for a moment that Blomqvist was serious. Then they all noticed his broad smile.
What you have to do this autumn is play a double game.
The disagreeable fact is that our dear managing editor, Janne Dahlman, is moonlighting as an informer for Hans-Erik Wennerström. This means that the enemy is being kept informed of exactly what's going on in our editorial offices. This explains a number of setbacks we've experienced, you especially, Sonny, when advertisers who seemed positive pulled out without warning. Dahlman had never been popular in the office, and the revelation was apparently not a shock to anyone. Blomqvist cut short the murmuring that started up. The reason that I'm telling you this is because I have absolute confidence in all of you. I know that you've got all your heads screwed on straight. That's why I also know that you'll play along with what takes place this autumn. It's very important that Wennerström believes that Millennium is on the verge of collapse. It will be your job to make sure he does. "What's our real situation?" Cortez said. "Okay, here it is. By all accounts, Millennium should be on its way to the grave. I give you my word that that's not going to happen. Millennium is stronger today than it was a year ago. When this meeting is over, I'm going to disappear again for about 2 months. Towards the end of October, I'll be back. Then we're going to clip Wennerström's wings."
"How are we going to do that?" Nielsen said.
"Sorry, Monica. I don't want to give you the details, but I'm writing a new story. And this time we're going to do it right. I'm thinking of having roast Wennerström for the Christmas party, and various critics for dessert." The mood turned cheerful. Blomqvist wondered how he would have felt if he were one of them sitting listening to all this. Dubious? Most likely. But apparently he still had some trust capital among Millennium's small group of employees. He held up his hand. "If this is going to work, it's important that Wennerström believes that Millennium is on the verge of collapse, because I don't want him to start some sort of retaliation, or indeed get rid of the evidence which we mean to expose. So we're going to start writing a script that you'll follow during the coming months. First of all, it's important that nothing we discuss here today is written down, or is referred to in emails. We don't know to what, if any, extent Dahlman has been digging around in our computers, and I've become aware that it's alarmingly simple to read co-workers' private email. So, we're going to do this orally. If you feel the need to air anything, go and see Krista at home. Very discreetly." Blomqvist wrote, "No email," on the whiteboard. "Second, I want you to start squabbling among yourselves, complaining about me when Dahlman is around. Don't exaggerate. Just give your natural bitchy selves full rein. Krista, I want you and Erica to have a serious disagreement. Use your imagination and be secretive about the cause." He wrote, "Start bitching," on the whiteboard. "Third, when Erica comes home, her job will be to see to it that Jana Dahlman thinks our agreement with the Wanger Corporation, which is in fact giving us its full support, has fallen through because Henrik Wanger is seriously ill and Martin Wanger died in a car crash." He wrote the word disinformation. "But the agreement really is solid?" Nielsen said. "Believe me," Blomqvist said, "the Wanger Corporation will go to great lengths to ensure that Millennium survives. In a few weeks, let's say at the end of August, Erica will call a meeting to warn you about layoffs. You all know that it's a scam, and that the only one who's going to be leaving is Dahlman. But start talking about looking for new jobs, and say what a lousy reference it is to have Millennium on your CV."
"And you really think that this game will end up saving Millennium?" Magnusson said.
"I know it will. And Sonny, I want you to put together a fake report each month, showing falling advertising sales and showing that the number of subscribers has also dropped."
"This sounds fun," Nielsen said. "Should we keep it internal here in the office, or should we leak it to other media too?"
"Keep it internal. If the story shows up anywhere, we'll know who put it there. In a very few months, if anyone asks us about it, we'll be able to tell them. You've been listening to baseless rumours, and we've never considered closing Millennium down. The best thing that could happen is for Dahlman to go out and tip off the other mass media. If you're able to give Dahlman a tip about a plausible but fundamentally idiotic story, so much the better." They spent an hour concocting a script and dividing up the various roles. After the meeting, Blomqvist had coffee with Malm at Java on Horngutspåkeln. "Krista, it's really important that you pick up Erica at the airport and fill her in. You have to convince her to play along with the game. If I know her, she'll want to confront Dahlman instantly, but that can't happen. I don't want Wennerström to hear any kind of buzz and then manage to bury the evidence."
"Will do.
And see to it that Erica stays away from her email until she installs the PGP encryption program,
and learns how to use it, it's pretty likely that through Dahlman, Venestrom is able to read everything we email to each other. I want you and everyone else in the editorial offices to install PGP. Do it in a natural way. Get the name of a computer consultant to contact and have him come over to inspect the network and all the computers in the office. Let him install the software as if it were a perfectly natural part of the service. I'll do my best.
But Mikhail, what are you working on?
Venestrom.
What exactly?
For the time being, that has to remain my secret.
Mom looked uncomfortable.
I've always trusted you, Mikhail. Does this mean that you don't trust me?
Blomqvist laughed.
Of course I trust you. But right now I'm involved in rather serious criminal activities that could get me 2 years in prison. It's the nature of my research that's a little dubious. I'm playing with the same underhand methods as Venestrom uses. I don't want you, or Erica, or anyone else at Millennium to be involved in any way.
You're making me awfully nervous.
Stay cool, Krista, and tell Erica that the story is going to be a big one. Really big.
Erica will insist on knowing what you're working on.
Mikhail thought for a second. Then he smiled. Tell her that she made it very clear to me in the spring, when she signed a contract with Henrik Wanger behind my back, that I'm now just an ordinary mortal freelancer who no longer sits on the board and has no influence on Millennium policy, which means that I no longer have any obligation to keep her informed. But I promise that if she behaves herself, I'll give her first option on the story.
She's going to go through the roof, Malm said cheerfully.
Blomqvist knew that he had not been entirely honest with Malm. He was deliberately avoiding Berger. The most natural thing would have been to contact her at once and tell her about the information in his possession, but he did not want to talk to her. A dozen times he had stood with his mobile in his hand, starting to call her, each time he changed his mind. He knew what the problem was. He could not look her in the eyes. The cover-up in which he had participated in Hedestad was unforgivable from a professional point of view. He had no idea how he could explain it to her without lying. And if there was one thing he had never thought of doing, it was lying to Erica Berger. Above all, he did not have the energy to deal with that problem at the same time as he was tackling Venestrom. So he put off seeing her, turned off his mobile, and avoided talking to her. But he knew that the reprieve could only be temporary. Right after the editorial meeting, Mikhail moved out to his cabin in Sandhamn. He hadn't been there in over a year. His baggage included 2 boxes of printouts and the CDs that Salander had given him. He stocked up on food, locked the door, opened his iBook and started writing. Each day he took a short walk, bought the newspapers and shopped for groceries. The guest marina was still filled with yachts, and young people who had borrowed their father's boat were usually sitting in the diver's bar drinking themselves silly. Blomqvist scarcely took in his surroundings. He sat in front of his computer more or less from the moment he opened his eyes until he fell into bed at night. Exhausted. Encrypted email from editor-in-chief, erica.berger@millennium.se, to publisher on leave of absence, mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
Mikhail, I want to know what's going on. Good grief, I've come back from holiday to total chaos. The news about Jana Dahlman and this double game you've come up with. Martin Wanger dead, Harriet Wanger alive. What's going on in Hedeby? Where are you? Is there a story? Why don't you answer your mobile? E. P.S. I understood the insinuation that Krista relayed with such glee. You're going to have to eat your words. Are you seriously cross with me? P.P.S. I am trusting you for the time being, but you are going to have to give proof, you remember, the stuff that stands up in court, on J.D.
From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to erica.berger@millennium.se.
Hi, Ricky. No, for God's sake, I'm not cross. Forgive me for not keeping you updated, but the past few months of my life have been topsy-turvy. I'll tell you everything when we see each other, but not by email. I'm at Sandhamn. There is a story, but the story is not Harriet Wanger. I'm going to be glued to my computer here for a while, then it'll be over. Trust me. Hugs and kisses. M.
From erica.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
Sandhamn? I'm coming to see you immediately.
From mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se to erica.berger@millennium.se.
Not right now. Wait a couple of weeks, at least until I've got the story organized. Besides, I'm expecting company.
From erica.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist@millennium.se.
In that case, of course I'll stay away, but I have to know what's going on. Henrik Wanger has become CEO again, and he doesn't answer my calls. If the deal with Wanger is off, I absolutely need to know. Ricky. P.S. Who is she? From mikael.blomqvist@millennium.se to erika.berger@millennium.se.
First of all, no question of Henrik pulling out, but he is still working only a short day, and I'm guessing that the chaos after Martin's death and Harriet's resurrection is taking its toll on his strength. Second, Millennium will survive. I'm working on the most important report of our lives, and when we publish it, it's going to sink Venestrom once and for all. Third, my life is up and down right now, but as for you and me and Millennium, nothing has changed. Trust me. Kisses. Mikael. P.S. I'll introduce you as soon as an opportunity presents itself.
When Salander went out to Sandhamn, she found an unshaven and hollow-eyed Blomqvist, who gave her a quick hug and asked her to make some coffee and wait while he finished what he was writing. Salander looked around his cabin and decided almost at once that she liked it. It was right next to a jetty, with the water 3 paces from the door. It was only 16 by 20 feet, but it had such a high ceiling that there was space for a sleeping loft. She could stand up straight there. Just. Blomqvist would have to stoop. The bed was wide enough for both of them. The cabin had one large window facing the water, right next to the front door. That was where his kitchen table stood, doubling as his desk. On the wall near the desk was a shelf with a CD player and a big collection of Elvis and hard rock, which was not Salander's first choice. In a corner was a wood stove made of soapstone with a glazed front. The rest of the sparse furnishings consisted of a large wardrobe for clothes and linen, and a sink that also functioned as a washing alcove behind a shower curtain. Near the sink was a small window on one side of the cabin. Under the spiral stairs to the loft, Blomqvist had built a separate space for a composting toilet. The whole cabin was arranged like the cabin on a boat, with clever cubbyholes for stowing things. During her personal investigation of Mikael Blomqvist, Salander had found out that he had remodeled the cabin and built the furniture himself, a conclusion drawn from the comments of an acquaintance who had sent Mikael an email after visiting Sandhamn and was impressed by his handiwork. Everything was clean, unpretentious, and simple, bordering on Spartan. She could see why he loved this cabin in Sandhamn so much. After 2 hours, she managed to distract Mikael enough that he turned off his computer in frustration, shaved, and took her out for a guided tour. It was raining and windy, and they quickly retreated to the inn. Blomqvist told her what he was writing, and Salander gave him a CD with updates from Venestrom's computer. Then she took him up to the loft and managed to get his clothes off and distract him even further. She woke up late that night to find herself alone. She peered down from the loft and saw him sitting hunched over his computer. She lay there for a long time, leaning on one hand, watching him. He seemed happy, and she too felt strangely content with life. Salander stayed only 5 days before she went back to Stockholm to do a job for Armansky. She spent 11 days on the assignment, made her report, and then returned to Sandhamn. The stack of printed pages next to Mikael's iBook was growing. This time she stayed for 4 weeks. They fell into a routine. They got up at 8, ate breakfast, and spent an hour together. Then Mikael worked intently until late in the afternoon, when they took a walk and talked. Salander spent most of the days in bed, either reading books or surfing the net using Blomqvist's ADSL modem. She tried not to disturb him during the day. They ate dinner rather late, and only then did Salander take the initiative and force him up to the sleeping loft, where she saw to it that he devoted all his attention to her. It was as if she were on the very first holiday of her life. Encrypted email from erika.berger@millennium.se to mikael.blomqvist@millennium.se.
Hi, Em. It's now official. Janne Dahlman has resigned and starts working at Monopoly Financial Magazine in 3 weeks. I've done as you asked and said nothing, and everyone is going around playing monkey games. E. P.S. They seem to be having fun. Henry and Lotta had a fight and started throwing things at each other a couple of days ago. They've been messing with Dahlman's head so blatantly that I can't understand how he can miss seeing that it's all a put-up job.
From mikael.blomqvist@millennium.se to erika.berger@millennium.se.
Wish him good luck from me, will you? And let him go straight away. but lock up the silverware. Hugs and kisses. M. From erica.berger@millennium.se to mikhail.blomqvist.